From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. In America's war on drugs, the drugs seem to be winning. And now many policymakers are advocating a strategy that was once unthinkable, to legalize drugs. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with a senior editor for the conservative magazine, National Review, Richard Brookhiser. The magazine has just come out in favor of legalizing drugs. Ethan Nadelman is the director of the Lindesmith Center, a drug policy research institute. He'll tell us what it might be like to live with drugs, much as we live with alcohol use. And then we hear from substance abuse expert Joseph Califano about why he opposes the legalization of drugs. That's coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, this news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Clinton is calling for what he refers to as a revolution of the heart to reduce the rate of teenage pregnancy in the U.S. Mr. Clinton has launched a campaign to cut the teen pregnancy rate by a third over the next decade.
This is not a problem which can be solved in Washington. This is not a problem that can be dealt with by a politician's speech, no matter how statesmanlike. This is a challenge that has to be dealt with one-on-one-on-one throughout this country.
To lead the drive to reduce teen pregnancy, the president has chosen his failed Surgeon General nominee, Dr. Henry Foster. Mr. Clinton has named Foster a special advisor on teenage pregnancy and youth issues. A Navy fighter jet crashed just after taking off from the Nashville International Airport today. The plane plowed into a suburban area, setting several houses ablaze. At least five people were killed. Jeff Seaver was in a nearby office building when the plane went down.
It had to go right over the top of our roof because it shook our whole building like an earthquake. And then all of a sudden you heard like a sonic boom on the other side of the interstate and you saw this big, thick black smoke.
The F-14 was on a routine training mission and had just refueled and was heading back to its home base in San Diego. The plane's two crew members were among those killed in the crash. French President Jacques Chirac has called an early end to France's controversial underground nuclear testing program in the South Pacific. In a televised speech, Chirac said the sixth test, which was conducted last weekend, was the last. Eight tests were originally planned. The testing program provoked protests around the world. Mexico today plans to repay part of the money it borrowed from the U.S. to bail out the peso after the currency collapsed more than a year ago. NPR's David Wellner reports from Mexico City.
Mexican officials say they will pay the U.S. today the $1.3 billion originally due last October. Mexico issued bonds in Germany to raise the money for today's payment, offering investors there more than a 10% annual return. Mexico must still repay the U.S. another $10.5 billion, which it also borrowed last year. The loans were guaranteed with Mexican oil revenues, and there's been speculation in recent months that the country might be forced to forfeit those vital revenues to meet loan payments. But Mexico's ability to sell bonds abroad, even if it means paying premium returns, appears to have staved off such forfeitures for now. While the country's economy continues to be wobbly, foreign investment, which fell sharply last year, is on the rise again. I'm David Wellner in Mexico City.
A new study finds that women now own one-third of the companies that do all of their business in the United States, and the report concludes that women who own businesses are growing in economic power. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 16.25 points at 5,287 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Four children died in their sleep last night from smoke inhalation during a fire that raced through their row house in Wilmington, Delaware. Neighbors tried in vain to rescue the two boys and two girls. San Francisco's Board of Supervisors votes today on whether to offer a new civil ceremony for domestic partners. Meanwhile, the State Assembly is set to vote this week on a bill to disallow gay marriages performed in other states. From member station KQED, Eric Jansen reports.
Supervisors are expected to pass an ordinance this afternoon that would allow San Francisco's county clerk to perform domestic partnership ceremonies. They would not confer any of the legal rights or obligations of marriage. More than 3,000 unmarried couples, mostly gay or lesbian, are already registered with the city as domestic partners. The certification helps them claim domestic partner benefits offered by some employers. While the addition of a symbolic ceremony seems likely in San Francisco, a bill in Sacramento could forbid California from recognizing gay marriages performed in other states. The full assembly is expected to vote tomorrow or Wednesday on the bill by Republican Pete Knight. Knight's bill was prompted by the prospect that Hawaii may soon legalize same-sex marriage. If Knight's bill passes the assembly, it would need the state senate's and the governor's approval to become law. For National Public Radio, I'm Eric Jansen in San Francisco.
Researchers for the pharmaceutical firm Merck & Company say a new experimental drug is showing impressive results in fighting AIDS when used in combination with two anti-AIDS drugs already on the market. One scientist says early studies of Merck's protease inhibitor Indinavir show that the drug, temporarily at least, eliminated all detectable traces of the AIDS virus in about 90% of the test subjects treated. The researchers say Indinavir, combined with two other drugs, appears to be by far the most powerful AIDS therapy ever tested on people. But they caution that the therapy is not a cure, and they say much more testing will be required to be sure the virus-killing properties of the drug last. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Legalizing drugs is an appalling thought to many people. But this week, two national magazines are featuring cover stories presenting arguments in favor of it. The latest issue of National Review, the longstanding conservative magazine edited by William F. Buckley, says the war on drugs is lost. And New York Magazine has a cover story titled, "Drugs Are Bad, the War on Drugs is Worse." National Review's editors write that although the magazine has long published analyses of the drug problem, up until now it's refrained from offering a formal opinion on legalization. With this issue, however, it's come out with a stand in favor of some movement towards legalization and offers essays by leading advocates of the idea, one of whom, Ethan Nadelman, we'll hear from later on in today's show. We'll also speak with Joseph Califano, the president of the Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University, a vocal opponent of legalizing drugs. But first, my guest is Richard Burkheiser, a senior editor at National Review and a columnist for the New York Observer. He's also the author of the new book, Founding Father, Rediscovering George Washington. I asked Richard Burkheiser why National Review has chosen this moment in time to come out with a formal position on legalizing drugs.
The vectors of all our analysis was pointing in this direction, and so we might as well come to the conclusion. And of course, also as time goes on, we're 10 years into the war on drugs under that name, and the bad consequences accumulate. So it becomes more necessary to take a stand.
Well, some people argue that crime is going down in major cities all over the country, and that the addict population is not growing, that we're not losing the war. How do you counter?
Well, in two ways. I think the good effects that the war is seeking to have are pretty small, are marginal. The use of certain drugs is going down. Marijuana and cocaine use has been declining for a long time, but that decline started before the war on drugs began. So it's hard to see how our efforts have produced it. On the other hand, the secondary bad effects are still there, and they're really not things we ought to live with. There is the violence in the cities, which is still much worse than it was, say, 30 years ago, even though lately the rates have taken a downturn. There is still the crowding of drug cases on the dockets of our courts and the crowding of prison cells with drug offenders. We still have problems with corruption because the enormous profits that come to drug pushers and to the drug industry, a part of that is siphoned off to policemen and judges and bankers in order to lubricate the thing, and that is still with us. And then finally, the psychology of the war on drugs has spilled over into regular medicine. Terminally ill patients cannot get the pain medication they need because doctors are afraid they'll become addicted, which is ludicrous, but that is the way people think in hospitals. And illegal drugs, which can help people with a variety of medical conditions, are unavailable. And there's no steps on the part of the government to test them or to rethink its position. And the classic example there, and this is where I come into this personally, is marijuana, which seems to have good effects for a variety of ailments or the symptoms of the ailments, AIDS, chemotherapy, glaucoma, multiple sclerosis. And I myself had cancer in 1992, and I had to undergo chemotherapy, and it's all done and it's over. But chemotherapy makes you very nauseous, and the drugs they give you for nausea, the legal drugs, are good, but they only work up to a point. And past that point, the only effective thing was marijuana. So I had to become a criminal in order to get it.
How would you say then that the conservatives now coming out in favor of some kind of debate on the legalization of drugs are redefining the debate? Are they reframing it, taking it away from issues of being tough on crime, the rhetoric of the war on crime?
Well, look, I believe in being tough on crime. And, you know, I know Bill Buckley does, National Review does. I also don't see this as a libertarian versus social conservative issue. I'm a social conservative. You know, I support the Christian Coalition and the Moral Majority before it, and I think they were a force for good in politics. But you can't fight crime effectively if you're going after crimes that are going to be impossible to eradicate, and if your pursuit of them leads to tremendous police corruption. You can't think seriously about morality if you are pursuing vices, again, which the state has no capacity effectively to pursue.
My guest is Richard Brookhiser. He's a senior editor at National Review and a columnist for the New York Observer. We're talking about drug legalization and the rise among some conservatives who support some measures of legalization. William Buckley argues in favor of legalization from the libertarian perspective, that drug use is a matter of personal responsibility and that more people die every year as a result of the war against drugs, drug gang warfare, street crime, adulterated black market drugs, than die from overdoses. But if drugs were legalized, wouldn't more people start overdosing as more people and children gain much greater access to dangerous and highly addictive drugs?
Well, look, they would still be illegal for children. No one is recommending that. But yes, more people would take them. And inevitably, more people, more children would get them than now do. However, the increase would not be nearly as significant as what the proponents of the drug war tell you it is. I mean, they toss around figures such as that cocaine use would go up to 30 million or even 60 million. It's now, according to the government's own figures, it's 3 million people use it and 500,000 people use it once a week or more. So that is an enormous increase that they're forecasting. The last model we had of an end of prohibition was alcohol in 1933, and alcohol use went up 25%. Now, you know, to go from 3 million to 30 million or 60 million, you're talking about 1,000% or 2,000%. And 25% is much less than that. So yes, you would get an increase in drug use. This is not without cost, and there are going to be lives lost along the way, and blighted along the way. But they're being blighted now already, and the increase in them would be, although you know every individual life is significant, it's not going to be the kind of thing that the Drug Enforcement Agency or other people would tell you.
So how do you explain the seeming contradictions in the openness of many in the conservative ranks to even talking about the idea of legalizing drugs?
Well, there might be, I think there are two things. First of all, we say we don't like bureaucracies, and for the most part, we really don't, especially big ones that are not doing their job and that are causing a lot of problems in the course of not doing it. And the drug bureaucracies, when you think about them, they turn out to be a classic example of this. So that goes against the conservative grain there. I think another parallel that's very striking to me is the parallel with gun control. I mean, when liberals say that guns are magical, malign objects, which of themselves compel people to shoot them off and commit crimes and murders and so on, conservatives can see through that. Okay? They resist calls to gun control based on those sorts of arguments. Now, of course, the anti-drug arguments are exactly the same thing, and we fall for that. But I think maybe it is trickling, maybe it is becoming evident to some conservatives that there's a parallel in these lines of arguing, and that we shouldn't buy the argument as it relates to drugs, which we reject as it relates to guns.
A lot of money has been spent, obviously, on the war on drugs. Would you say that you would invert that equation to spend as much money as we spend on the war and invest it into public health policies to lessen addiction? And how would that go over among conservatives? How would that go over politically?
Well, look, it goes over if you look at all the money that's being spent. I mean, the money that's being spent on the war on drugs is not just the budgets of the Drug Enforcement Agency. There is a lot of money that goes into policing, a vast amount of the resources that go into policing and into prison building, which is directly tied to the war on drugs and which could be, you know, productively shifted to other kinds of policing. And that would be a tremendous gain. So, you might look at the bottom line and see, well, yes, the public health spending would go up because we might decide to prescribe heroin to addicts, and that costs money. But the other side of the ledger is much more than the amount you'll be saving on specific drug-related agencies. And so I think it's a good trade-off.
Right now we have mandatory minimum sentencing for drug use and drug dealing. What changes do you recommend in the criminal justice system?
Well, mandatory sentencing seems to be a bad idea. One of our contributors is Robert Sweet, who is a district judge serving here in New York, and that was the turning point for him when he decided that the war on drugs was a mistake, when he found himself handing out very stiff minimum sentences for first-time offenders and for minor offenders. And one effect of this is that we are filling up our prisons with drug offenders at a time when we're straining to add new cells to hold criminals who should be there, who ought to be put away. But we have trouble doing it because there are so many drug offenders taking up the space. So that is something that has to be rethought.
What models do you all of the National Review want your readers to walk away with in their mind? Models of a different take on the war on drugs, not a war, but a public health policy war, which is what Mayor Kurt Schmoke has called for. What models do you want people to look to, or are we looking to Europe?
Well, we're looking to certain things that some European countries are doing. The ways heroin addiction is treated in perhaps in England, or the way they're experimenting with it in Switzerland, is something we have to look at, and we have to see how it's worked. This is an experiment. We can look at the results. We can look at some of our needle exchange programs here in this country. Baltimore has one. And if indeed, you know, AIDS rates go down as a result of this, well, then we consider that as a successful thing to do at the margin. We don't do it now because there's such a hue and cry. It's thought that needle exchanges or allowing needles to be sold would be pro-drug, so it doesn't get done. I think the basic thing, the primary thing we'd like our readers to walk away with is the notion that the war psychology is the wrong model for doing this. And William James coined the phrase about the moral equivalent of war, but that was a real bad phrase because there aren't moral equivalents of war. A war is a war, and when you fight it, you're fighting an enemy of your country's freedom or of its vital national interest, and you're willing to pull out almost all the stops. But short of that, you shouldn't be talking about wars and the language of wars.
Richard Brookhiser, thank you for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
Richard Brookhiser is a senior editor at National Review. We'll be back with another look at drug legalization after this break. This is Fresh Air. For more than a decade, Ethan Nadelman has been writing about the costs and consequences of drug prohibition in the United States. Nadelman is a former professor of politics and public affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. He's currently the director of the Lindesmith Center, a drug policy research institute in New York City. In his essay in the latest edition of National Review, Nadelman argues that our drug control policies cause more harm than the drugs themselves. He feels the time has come to abandon the concept of a drug-free society and to institute some measure of legal availability and regulation. When I spoke with Ethan Nadelman, I asked him to support his claim that the war on drugs has been lost.
Well, I think it's failed by its own criteria. If this war has succeeded, drug abuse would be a minor problem in America. If this war had succeeded, we would probably not be incarcerating hundreds of thousands of Americans and arresting a million a year for drug law violations. If this war had succeeded, we would not have a dreadful drug-related AIDS problem and all the other drug-related problems we have. So by its chosen criteria, the war on drugs has failed. Now, Barbara, I think it's important, though, to realize that we're not just talking about a war on drugs. We're talking about a drug prohibition system, very much like alcohol prohibition was 60 years ago, except more severe in many respects. I mean, it's not just that we should shift more resources toward treatment and prevention instead of waging a criminal justice fight in this area, which is something we should do. It's a good half step. It's that prohibition itself, treating drugs as a prohibition problem, using prohibition laws, is responsible for most of what Americans commonly identify as part and parcel of the drug problem. And in this respect, it's just like alcohol prohibition. I mean, we instituted alcohol prohibition in 1919 because we thought we could get rid of alcohol drinking and alcohol problems. And in fact, prohibition was moderately successful, at least in its initial years, in reducing alcohol consumption and alcohol-related ills. But by the end of alcohol prohibition, alcohol use had gone way up. And at the same time, what had emerged was Al Capone and organized crime and rising levels of violence and corruption, overflowing prisons and courthouses and jail cells, tens of millions of Americans breaking the law, an atmosphere of lawlessness, as well as tens of thousands of Americans dying from bad bootleg liquor, liquor that was more dangerous because it was illegal. Now, it's the same thing today. Drug prohibition may discourage some people from becoming drug users. Drug prohibition may reduce drug abuse some small degree. But look at what it generates. I mean, drug-related, or I should say prohibition-related crime and violence. So many of the homicides in our inner cities are prohibition-related, not drug-related so much, but prohibition-related.
Isn't that the fear, though, that many voice about legalization, that once you ease up, there's no going back, that the issue is to legalize or not to legalize?
That is the fear that people express, but it's not all that well-based. I mean, you know, the United States has a long history with what are called sunset laws, where you basically say that you will do a new policy for 2 years or 3 years, and then it will be evaluated. And if it's not proving satisfactory, you go back on it, you repeal it. So one can, in fact, well, like, look what Switzerland's doing right now. They didn't legalize drugs 2 years ago. They started a national experiment to prescribe heroin to hardcore drug addicts in Zurich and Bern and a number of other cities. And they wanted to see. They took a group of a few hundred serious drug addicts, people who had tried to quit both with methadone in therapeutic communities and had persistently failed. Half of them probably have HIV or AIDS. And they said, the authorities said, we know that heroin doesn't destroy the human body. We know from the scientific and historical evidence that people can lead a semi-normal life as a heroin addict if they have access to clean, legal, pharmaceutical-grade heroin. It's not like cocaine or alcohol or even cigarettes where it destroys your body organs. So they started a program to give drug addicts, or to sell it to them actually for about $10, $15 a day, heroin, clean, legal heroin in clinics. Now, they've been doing this now for 2 years, and the program has been sufficiently successful that they've expanded it to almost 1,000 slots in 13 cities around the country. When they define success, what they mean is that the health of the addicts has improved dramatically. It appears that they're less involved with crime. Their use of illicit drugs has declined. There have been no overdose deaths. There has been almost no problem of heroin being diverted to the streets. That by and large, the overall situation involving heroin addicts and their impact on the community has improved. Now, one of the things, I mean, you know, to talk about a heroin prescription program is not talking about legalization, and it's also not talking about something you can never go back on. It's talking about taking a scientific, common sense, humane approach to a serious problem and seeing pragmatically what works.
I think that the standards, at least of the president administration, are to work towards a drug-free society, and that one administration official phrased the idea of giving up the war on drugs is throwing in the towel, and that's the message you're sending to the nation, to our nation's youth.
I know. I mean, it's a little ludicrous in a way. I mean, in 1988, Congress passed a resolution where they declared that America would be a drug-free society by 1995. Now, that's an absurd, ludicrous notion. The bottom line is that drugs are here to stay. Drugs have always been here. Drugs are always going to be here. Virtually every civilized society in human history has had powerful psychoactive drugs in its midst. The ones that have been most successful in dealing with drugs have not been those that sought to eradicate them through totalitarian means or what have you. It's been those societies that figured out how to learn to live with drugs in such a way that they cause the least possible harm. Can we, for example, by promoting designated driving norms, reduce fatalities on the roads? By using seatbelts and encouraging seatbelts, can we reduce fatalities? By cracking down on drunken driving? By teaching kids the difference between responsible alcohol use and irresponsible alcohol use? These are all ways of reducing the harms associated with alcohol. And I think the same sort of approach is needed with illicit drugs.
So how would this work if you, say, legalized cocaine? What would a federal drugstore look like?
Well, at the end of alcohol prohibition, people said, what should come after alcohol prohibition? And what we decided on was a high measure of local option, that states and local communities should be able to control this. I think the same is true when we talk about legalizing marijuana, cocaine, heroin, Valium, I mean, any other drug that you want to talk about. Now, let me just say, Barbara, one of the minimums that I think we would need nationally, however, is that American adults, it should be legal for an adult to possess and consume a small amount of any drug for personal use, so long as they do not engage in a dangerous behavior like getting behind the wheel of a car. I mean, I think that crucial ingredient, that the legalization of personal possession, is a central ingredient of any alternative drug control policy. The interesting questions emerge when you decide, how do we make drugs legally available? That's where the tough issues are, and that's where much of the debate is when people start to think about a post-prohibition America.
Ethan Nadelman is the director of the Linda Smith Center, a drug policy research institute in New York City. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue with the second part of our discussion with Ethan Nadelman, the director of the Linda Smith Center, a drug policy research institute in New York City. When we left off, we touched on how drugs would be distributed if they were decriminalized. How do you explain how the free market economy would work? I mean, now that there is a whole criminal infrastructure, I mean, where would our federal drug state stores or whatever get their cocaine if we started growing it here, developing our own domestic market, certainly?
Well, I don't really think, I mean, that's not a tough issue, really. I mean, right now, coca and cocaine is produced in both legally and illegally throughout South America. Now, I think when you talk about cocaine, it's important to realize that, first of all, we wouldn't just legalize cocaine and nothing else. I mean, this would be in the context of making available a variety of drugs, stimulants, depressants, what have you, under fairly strictly regulated conditions, but some of those might be safer than cocaine. And in fact, given a wider array of options, consumers might opt for something other than cocaine. Also understand that cocaine, you know, one just can't talk about cocaine as a single drug. I mean, there is a world of difference between the cocaine that is consumed in Bolivia and Peru when the Indians chew the coca leaf and get the cocaine that comes from the leaf, as opposed to yuppies snorting a line of cocaine, as opposed to yuppies freebasing, as opposed to poor inner-city people smoking crack. I mean, it's the same drug, cocaine, but the consequences of that use are radically, radically different, depending both upon the nature of the drug, the way it's consumed, and who's consuming it. So when we talk about legalization of cocaine, I think where one would start would be with the low-potency cocaines. I mean, Bolivia and Peru now would like to be able to export low-potency cocaine products, coca tonics, coca teas, coca medicines, coca toothpaste, these sorts of things, which have almost no danger of addiction associated with them. They're probably more innocuous than caffeinated beverages are. There's no reason not to allow Bolivia and Peru to do that, except for our sort of moral craze against cocaine. So I would make available, under different types of legal regulatory models, low-potency cocaine. I don't think it's necessary for the government to stand out there and start making legally available crack cocaine. No more, for example, than it was necessary at the end of alcohol prohibition for the government to start selling 180-proof moonshine. I mean, the bottom line was people bought moonshine because that's what they could get during prohibition, but most wanted beer or beer and wine. It's the same thing today. Crack is in very many respects the moonshine of drug prohibition. It's not clear that we would have a major crack market in America if it were legal, and in fact, most Americans tend to prefer those drugs which are relatively less dangerous. So, I mean, we can work this out. Believe me, any approach is better than the current one, where we have tens of billions of dollars being made by criminals marketing cocaine in its most lethal forms today.
Are you saying that increased exposure to drugs doesn't matter, doesn't result in more addicts?
Well, it depends what you mean by increased exposure. Let's not forget that we already live in a world in which we are all incredibly exposed to drugs. We live in a world in which alcoholic beverages are widely available, and any kid who wants to get it can get it, in which cigarettes are widely available, a world in which you can buy drugs over the counter, anti-congestants, what have you, and get high as a kite if you want to, where you can get drugs from a doctor. I mean, anybody more or less in the middle class who wants Prozac or Valium can more or less get those drugs if they know the right doctor. So we can get that. We can get alcohol, tobacco, over-the-counter, under-the-counter, behind-the-counter drugs. And then for those people who are simply too poor or too young, well, they go and sniff gasoline or sniff glue or they use something else. I mean, anybody who thinks that somehow if you got rid of cocaine tomorrow that we would still have a drug problem should look in the poorest parts of the world where there are millions of kids sniffing glue, sniffing petrol, and there's nothing the law enforcement establishment can do about that. So don't think that legalization means all of a sudden we live in a drug-infested Sodom and Gomorrah world. In fact, we already live in a world where drugs are everywhere. We already live in a world where most of us have learned how to live with drugs. Making drugs legally available will modestly increase the availability of drugs. It'll dramatically decrease the connection between those drugs and crime.
What public health policy initiative should then accompany a change in our drug policy?
Well, I mean, I'm a strong supporter of very powerful harm reduction-oriented public health approaches to substance abuse. I mean, I think that we have to accept the fact that there's a few million people in this country who are hardcore drug users, and we want to reduce the death, disease, and crime that they're involved in. Now, that means making needles readily available. It means making methadone as available as possible to drug addicts. I mean, people don't realize methadone is to street heroin more or less what nicotine chewing gum or a nicotine patch is to cigarettes. It can make you addicted or dependent. That's hard to quit, but it causes virtually no harm to the human body. What it's designed to do is to reduce the negative consequences of street heroin or tobacco, the crime or the poisonings or the cancer. We should make methadone much more available. Instead of doing what we do now, which is to, it's now this most strictly regulated drug in the entire pharmacopoeia. I mean, people can't go to a doctor and get methadone. They have to go to some clinic, which may be dozens or hundreds of miles from their home. So I'd make methadone more widely available. I would experiment with heroin prescription, like they're doing in Switzerland now, and like the Dutch and the Australians are about to start. I would certainly make both heroin and marijuana available for medical purposes. I mean, I think it's a national scandal that people who are sick cannot get marijuana to deal with glaucoma, to deal with the nausea that attends chemotherapy, to deal with some of the symptoms of the AIDS wasting syndrome. I mean, that's purely immoral to deprive sick people of medication. I would go further. I would institute some measure of marijuana legal availability, allowing states and localities to control it. But I'd also put forward a very serious drug education campaign. I mean, I would go far beyond our current just say no approach.
The first anti-opium laws in the 19th century were directed at Chinese immigrants in California who ran opium dens. Does the history of our anti-drug legislation follow this pattern of singling out minorities?
Very much so. The first anti-opium laws in America were directed at Chinese immigrants in California and Nevada and associated with anti-Chinese sentiment. The first anti-cocaine laws in America were in the southern states in the first decade of the century, and they were directed at blacks. It was feared that Negroes would forget themselves and go out and rape white women and would be immune to gunshot from police officers if they were crazed on cocaine. The first anti-marijuana laws in this country were in the 1920s in the Midwest and were directed at Mexican immigrants. So there's a very powerful connection between the origins of our drug laws and racism. And I think the same continues to hold true today. I mean, why is it? We take an activity like selling cocaine Now, that's an activity that was legal 100 years ago. Now we incarcerate people for up to life for engaging in that activity. And we now have, I mean, there's 1.5 million Americans behind bars today. About one quarter of them, about 350,000, are there for violating a drug law. And they're there oftentimes for very, very long periods of time because of mandatory minimum sentences. Why are we willing to do that? My own impression is that if we were incarcerating hundreds of thousands of middle-class white Americans, we would not be so ready to throw people away and throw away the key. I do think it is because this is a business in which inner city blacks and Hispanics have been disproportionately represented that the American public is much more willing to toss these people away and just forget about them. So I do think that racism in a subtle way, much more subtle than it was before, but nonetheless in a subtle way, does continue to shape American drug policy.
Are you in favor of a large federal investment and federally run program for rehabilitation of drug addicts?
I believe that the government should include funds for drug treatment as part of its overall health care. There's right now most drug treatment for poor people, I think, is paid through Medicare. There are specialized drug treatment programs, but a lot of it comes through their major healthcare system. I think, in fact, I know that the traumatic cuts in healthcare expenditures that are being either enacted or proposed are going to devastate access to drug treatment for poor people in America, and that the results are going to be more disease, more death, and more crime because people will be forced to turn to the streets to get drugs that they can't get from doctors and hospitals. But quite frankly, if we could cut the law enforcement budget on drugs by 80% and just give half of that to drug treatment, we would have remarkable, remarkable improvement in our drug situation in America.
How then would you rate the importance in the larger context of rehabilitation? Is it 50%? Is it as important as any other aspect of the program? Is it the most important aspect of a change in our drug policy?
Now, if I was going to expand drug treatment in this country, I would focus on the voluntary aspects of drug treatment, the needle exchange programs, the methadone clinics, where people go because they want to go there, where people go to seek help. The whole push in America today is in favor of coercive drug treatment, is that we only want to give people services if we're coercing them, if we're punishing them. Well, I think that's morally abhorrent, and I don't think it's very effective. I think we should do as much as we can to make treatment services available, accessible, and attractive to people who have problems with drugs. And that's what would work best for American society at large as well.
Ethan Nadelman, I want to thank you very much for talking on Fresh Air today.
Hey, Barbara, thank you very much.
Ethan Nadelman is the director of the Linda Smith Center, a drug policy research institute in New York City. We'll be back with an argument against legalizing drugs after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Joseph Califano, approaches the debate on the war on drugs from the vantage point of 30 years of experience in public health and social welfare programs. Califano advised President Johnson on the creation of such programs as Medicare and Medicaid as an assistant for domestic affairs in the late 60s. And he served as Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare during President Carter's first 2 years in office. He's the founder and president of CASA, the Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University. CASA researches how addiction of all kinds affects American society and tests the effectiveness of drug treatment programs. The center published a landmark study last fall on drug legalization. The study found that legalizing drugs would result in a catastrophic increase in addiction and in addiction-related health and social problems. When I spoke with Joseph Califano earlier today, he took issue with the premise that the war on drugs has failed.
The war on drugs is not lost. A tremendous amount of progress has been made in reducing casual drug use. There have been sharp drops in casual drug use from the 1980s into the early 1990s in the use of marijuana and the use of cocaine. That's number one. Number two, there's been a significant drop in the use of crack, reflected by the decline in crime in almost all of our major cities. And number three, the number of addicts, hardcore addicts, as we would call them, has remained about the same, has not increased over the last several years. So that I think we can say that progress has been made. Now, in the last couple of years, there's been a blip up in the use of marijuana and in the emergency room deaths from cocaine and heroin. In terms of marijuana, I think that we can attribute that in good measure to a sense of a relaxation of the message that drugs are not good for you. We've done a survey at CASA which indicates that one of the things that has a tremendous impact on whether young people use drugs is whether or not they perceive marijuana as dangerous.
Your study that you referred to was called Legalization Panacea or Pandora's Box. And to follow up on the argument you just presented, one of the things that the study concluded was that if we make drugs as easy for young people to get as alcohol and cigarettes are now, that there would be a pediatric pandemic in the U.S. Explain those further.
Well, I think what we have to recognize is that in the United States, 3 million adolescents smoke cigarettes, an average of a half a pack a day. It's a $1 billion market. 12 million children and underage Americans drink beer and alcohol, about a $10 billion market. Although alcohol use is illegal for children in high school, 87% of high school seniors report drinking more than half in the past month. Now, you contrast that with the fact that only 18% of seniors use illegal drugs. You can see what would happen. What's the difference? The difference is that alcohol is legal and available widely available. Cigarettes are widely available. We would never be able to keep drugs out of the hands of our children if they were made legally available. So when we say we'd have a pediatric pandemic, we would. We would have widespread drug use by our children. And when somebody talks about legalizing drugs, they're basically, in fact and in reality, talking about letting America's children have access to marijuana and cocaine and other drugs, because we have shown no ability to keep alcohol and cigarettes and drugs like that out of the hands of our kids.
I don't think, though, that people who support legalization are saying we're going to throw these drugs at children. I don't think anyone is purporting to.
Barbara,
make it.
I don't think the tobacco industry vehemently tells us that they have no interest in selling cigarettes to American children. The reality of tobacco addiction in the United States is that if America's children didn't get hooked on cigarettes, in one generation, the cigarette companies would be out of business. The beer and alcohol companies tell us they have absolutely no interest in selling alcohol or beer to America's children. Yet the America's children and underage individuals provide a $10 billion a year market for beer and alcohol in this country. And if you don't abuse alcohol when you're a youngster, you're very unlikely to do it when you're an adult. Now, if you legalize cocaine and you legalize heroin and you legalize marijuana, and they begin to get the protections of commercial free speech that alcohol and tobacco claim they have and have been successful in using, it is really naive to think that those drugs will not become available to America's children, that they will not become glamorized by somebody. Secondly, we have been total failures in keeping cigarettes and alcohol out of the hands of our kids. There is no experience to indicate that we'd have any better success with illegal drugs. It doesn't surprise me that those who would propose legalization say that they do not want the children to use drugs.
One argument for drug legalization is that the government could regulate the quality and the purity of drugs, which would result in fewer overdoses and cases of poisoning from adulterated drugs. How do you counter that reasoning?
Well, the government has shown precious little ability to regulate the quality of cigarettes. You know, the legalizers say, well, in Prohibition we had all this wood alcohol and people got sick and what have you. The reality of that is quite to the contrary. Death rates, for example, from cirrhosis of the liver fell from 12 per 100,000 in 1916 to 5 per 100,000 in 1920 and stayed at that low level. And among men, death rates from cirrhosis dropped even more sharply, from almost 30 per 100,000 in 1911 to 10.7 per 100,000 in 1929. Also, admissions to mental health institutions for alcoholic psychosis went down by more than 60%. During Prohibition, and arrests for drunkenness went down, as you might expect, quite sharply by about half. The point is that we would not do anything but increase our illness and, incidentally, our health care costs if drugs were more widely available.
Another argument, though, for legalization points to the fact that if less potent versions of a drug, let's say cocaine, are available to people, then they'll opt to take a less potent drug rather than harder stuff.
You know, that incidentally is, by every standard of experience we have where people have legalized drugs, turns out not to be true. Even the current, you know, the Swiss started with the theory that they would have a few people in Needle Park in Zurich, and a couple of hundred people quickly drew to 20,000 people. They're now testing a program in which they're giving people heroin. Well, they have a tremendous dropout rate in that program. Why? Because the people aren't getting enough heroin. in the Swiss program, so they go out and they want more heroin, or they want to mix their heroin with cocaine. We have no evidence that that works. Even, I must say, with respect in this country to methadone programs, if you talk to people that have really looked at those programs, like Congressman Rangel in Harlem, which has a severe drug problem, he'll tell you that methadone is basically like another drug, and that the methadone has not stopped that many people from using heroin or using other drugs.
Joseph Califano is my guest. He's the founding president of CASA, the Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Joseph Califano. He's the founder and president of CASA, the Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University. Many people on both sides of this debate on drug reform support the decriminalization and legalization, at the very least, for medicinal purposes of marijuana. Your study last fall had some alarming data on marijuana. Why don't you tell us about that research?
Well, I think that what we reported was the fact that we've learned a lot about marijuana in the last 20 years in this country. And we learned that in the medical research and the medical experiments that have been done and analyses that have been done, that one, marijuana savages short-term memory. It decreases one's ability to maintain their attention span. It affects motor skills. These are skills very important to young Americans in high school and elementary school and college who are learning, for whom short-term memory is very important and whose intellectual and physical development is very important for this country. There also are indications of the fact that marijuana, according to some studies, can have an impact with respect to the fetus of a woman who smokes while she's pregnant in terms of reducing the IQ of the child. We think marijuana is in and of itself dangerous, and Alan Leshner, the head of the National Institute of Drug Abuse, has repeatedly said that we know a lot about marijuana now. We didn't know 30 years ago, and it is dangerous. You know, we learned a lot about cigarettes from the time of the 1964 Surgeon General's report until the more recent times.
Well, there are hardly any prescription drugs that a pregnant woman should take, but there's mounting evidence of the medicinal efficacy of marijuana, you know, for a wide array of uses to fight nausea in people undergoing chemotherapy is just one example. Oh. Why not open up the marijuana debate?
Well, I think the question of marijuana for a medicinal use like that, or other people say that there may be uses related to glaucoma, I think that's a question for the doctors and the medical experts. I'm prepared to be guided by whatever they say in that regard.
Let's talk about harm reduction, which is the theory that many countries in Europe base their drug policy on, that drugs are here to stay and we should try to reduce their possible harms to the individual and to society. Right now, we maintain a policy of the goal is a drug-free America. In Europe, they say that's not realistic. Drugs are here. They're not going away. Why not reduce the harms?
Okay. The first step in reducing the harm, in my judgment, is to have a massive saturation education campaign directed at America's children from the earliest time they're in school throughout their entire education as part of a health promotion and disease prevention campaign that would cover drugs, alcohol, cigarettes, lifestyles, and the relationship to an individual's physical, intellectual, and spiritual development. Secondly, we're never going to have the Garden of Eden. The United States is not going to be the Garden of Eden. We will never have a society without problems or completely without drugs, but we can take a lot of steps to sharply reduce it. For those people who do get hooked, I think we should make every effort to give them treatment. We simply don't do that in the United States of America. The largest single captive audience that needs treatment are the people in prison, and by and large, those people are not offered any treatment. There is no hope of reducing in significant ways the bad things that come from using drugs, whether it's the crime or the healthcare costs or what have you, unless we begin to turn our attention to that prison population while they're captured. I think we should do that. People talk about needle exchanges. I think the jury is out on needle exchanges. That is the concept of having heroin addicts have access to clean needles so they don't transmit AIDS or other diseases through use of dirty needles. I think the jury is out on that, but I think that is certainly an experiment worth trying.
Do you agree with the paradigm, the war on drugs? Do you find that a positive or an effective approach?
Oh, if I could create a new term, I would not use the term the war on drugs. I think that it has too much, you know, the word war creates a kind of military sense of shoot 'em up. I think what we're talking about here is a much more complicated effort. And I think it's, dealing with drugs is dealing with, in America, with poverty. It's dealing with accessibility. It's dealing with cost. It's dealing with educating people about the dangers. And I think the term war is much too narrow.
Joseph Califano, I want to thank you for speaking with me on Fresh Air today.
It's been my pleasure, Barbara. Thank you.
Joseph Califano is the founding president of the Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University. Fresh Air's engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman and Al Banks. Audrey Bentham is our technical director. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of Civil Action, a real-life action thriller by Jonathan Harr. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.